This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, a Notre Dame business professor sounds the alarm on the state of the U.S. Postal Service, which he's been following closely ever since the 2006 Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act. He says without action from Congress, the Postal Service could shut down by this time next year. And later, how does working from home affect productivity? And how do you effectively manage it? An Indy-based Salesforce executive has been looking into the idea of working from home since 2002, and she's written a new book about it. But first, a quick recap of the state's biggest news items from the past week with our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. Let's start the way we have been for these last several months and look at the numbers, the COVID-19 data.
Yeah, so as of noon today, 3,058 people have died from COVID-19 since March. There are more than 91,000 confirmed cases, and more than a million Hoosiers have been tested. So to compare that to last week, we've got about 60 new deaths. There were more than 84,000 confirmed cases, and we were at about 958,000 Hoosiers who had been tested. So week-to-week comparison, that's about 7,000 new cases this week, including yesterday's total of 1,164 newly reported cases, and about 90,000 individuals have been tested over the last week. New cases have continued to climb, but again, still more slowly than the previous two or three weeks with those 1,000-plus case spikes. And today, the state reported 832 new cases, which is actually the fewest in 4 days.
Now, when we look at those day-to-day numbers, and just a few weeks ago, or maybe a little more than a month ago, it seemed like 900 was a big day. Mm-hmm. And now we're looking at 1,000 now. Is that the result of more testing, or is the rate going up?
So it's a little murky to kind of figure out, right? So the testing hasn't seen a huge increase. The state is now including antigen testing and things along those lines. Mm. But, I mean, the state's overall positivity rate has been steadily increasing. At least for the last week, it's actually been holding fairly steady with a little bit of a drop. So the number to focus on to see kind of where we are and how we're going is the positivity rate, which is delayed by a week from the state. And so that currently for the week, if the state website will load for me, is at 6.5%. And so that's actually the lowest we've seen in a hot minute. We've been hovering above 7% for a while. So this week is a good week for data. We're seeing a lot of those things trending down. There are also still concerning things about ICU numbers, hospitalizations. Again, nowhere near where we were in April comparatively, especially considering the spike in cases we've seen. But still, you know, very much concerning.
Well, and that leads us to the next news item, the extension of the mask mandate. What do we know?
Yeah, so these positive trends that we are starting to see aren't quite enough for the state to move forward with reopening plans. Holcomb announced Wednesday that he's extending the mask mandate and keeping the state in stage 4.5 for at least another month, which that stage is where we've been since early July. So that means, for instance, restaurants can only be at 75% capacity, while bars, nightclubs, and tourism sites are at 50%.
Okay. To kind of recap a little bit, we hit a grim milestone on COVID-19 deaths, of course. You said last week we were just under 1,000. When did we break over that number?
Saturday.
3,000.
Saturday was when we hit 3,000 confirmed deaths, which to also keep in mind, the state has been offering probable deaths. So if you include that, we hit 3,000 a few weeks ago. But
these are deaths that probably happened because of COVID, but we can't absolutely confirm that.
Yeah, that there wasn't a test run, but basically all symptoms and medical knowledge is like, oh yeah, no, that person totally had this virus. Mm-hmm. So over the weekend, the Indiana State Department of Health reported its 3,000th confirmed death since March 15th. But things to keep in mind when we're talking about this death number. So more than half of those deaths occurred before mid-May, which May 1st was when we when the governor announced that he was starting to reopen the economy. And nearly 60% of the 3,000 deaths actually come from long-term care facilities. Marion County has the highest number of deaths by far, with nearly 750 still. But Tipton and Decatur counties have the highest rate of deaths by population at 12.5 and 12.4 per 10,000 residents, respectively. Marion County only hits about seventh on that list, which is still high, but there are more rural counties that are struggling a little bit more with that.
Understood.
And while the state's reported cases have spiked over the last month, as we've talked about a number of times, the deaths have so far maintained an average of about 10 per day. So for comparison's sake, in the first month of the stay-at-home order, we averaged about 28 deaths per day. So this is far above and beyond greatly improved.
Okay. And following repeated requests for some guidance from local governments and schools, the state health department has finally released, some guidance in the form of what?
In the form of a color-coded map.
Which is your favorite kind of.
It honestly brings me so much joy. I could have talked about this map the entire time, and it wouldn't have been helpful for literally anyone. So the State Department of Health is launching a map. There's four different color categories. Brandon's story does an incredible job of explaining it. I'm not going to talk about that for the most part. But what it does, each county is given a color, blue, yellow, orange, or red, that indicates the severity of COVID-19 spread. And it's based on a formula of the number of new cases per 10,000 residents, the positivity rate, and the recent change in rate. And so here's the thing that I really, really like about this map, and the thing that I will geek out about for data visualization until the day I die. when we are talking about community spread, it's difficult to compare someplace like Marion County to Ohio County. I grew up in Indianapolis. I'm from the west side. I went to Ben Davis High School, where we had nearly the same population of students as all of the residents of Ohio County.
Goodness.
So it's difficult to compare just the raw numbers between those two places. So by focusing on cases per 100,000 residents, positivity rate, and recent change in that rate, you're getting a much better idea of what the data is actually saying in real time and in a way that is comparative from place to place. So I manage a map for IPB News that uses cases per 10,000 residents. And while I love and treasure my map, one of its shortcomings is that it focuses on cumulative data. So, for example, Cass County had a major outbreak earlier in the year and remains one of the highest cumulative cases per 10,000 residents. But Martin County, which has had a recent uptick in cases and is, in fact, highlighted by SDH's map example from Wednesday, it's the second lowest quintile of my map. So no matter how good the data is from ISDH, it's also important to note it's not mandating particular actions from school corporations. The department is providing guidelines, but the decision making is very much in the hands of local health departments and individual school corporations.
So that autonomy is still very much front and center here. The state is not controlling things. They're leaving it up to local governments, but they are providing this sort of enhanced and very easy to understand and read guidance. So
absolutely.
Do you think we've struck that balance?
I think that's a decision between a school superintendent and a local health department.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. We did a show yesterday on voting and voting methods, and vote by mail was very much in the center of that conversation. And in fact, we did the first segment with the president and vice president of the nonprofit Indiana Vote by Mail, which is also a nonpartisan organization. And what do we know about whether or not vote by mail will be expanded in this year's general election in November?
Not if state Republicans have anything to do about it. The Indiana Secretary of State, Connie Lawson, insists the state will have a normal election this fall and is not going to expand vote by mail amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Many Hoosiers, including even a lawsuit, have pushed the state to allow anyone to vote by mail in the general election. But as Indiana did for its primary, but Republicans, including Lawson, have rejected those requests. There are about a dozen reasons you can legally cast a mail-in ballot, including if you're confined to your home by illness. Lawson said fears over COVID-19 for those high-risk populations might fall under that provision, but she said if you're still going to the grocery store or running other errands, you're not confined to your home. So, okay. And Indiana is one of just six states that refuses to expand vote by mail this fall.
Okay. And what did Brandon do a breakdown for this?
Yes, he did. He did he actually did a really dope comparison of highlight of the 11 reasons why you can cast a mail-in ballot. He also did a video this week for the Indiana 2022 Way the Video series, talking about what the election might look like come this November. So check out all of those things. I'll tweet them.
Very, very cool. 11 excuses, as it were. And those who are pushing vote by mail are pushing what they like to call no excuse vote by mail. Mm-hmm. So the eviction moratorium was lifted on August 14th, 2 weeks ago today. And so now what is the state doing to, I guess keep some of those cases out of court, it seems like.
Yeah, so housing advocates are concerned about a tsunami of evictions. There have been a lot of water-based comparisons from housing advocates, and the state's response to that is a mediation program to Hoosier landlords and their tenants at risk of eviction. It's free of charge from the Indiana government. However, the landlord and renter must agree to the mediation, and the goal is to keep eviction cases out of court whenever possible. So potential settlement outcomes can include payment plans and back payments, but they still also can involve eviction or an alternative that, you know, keeps eviction off of a person's record, but, you know, is still essentially eviction. And I mean, all of this is so important as a National Housing Stability Organization estimates as many as 720,000 Hoosiers are at risk of eviction because of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Uh-huh. Well, that's our time for today. Hey, she holds down the fort while the rest of us, like me, work from our basement. She's Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Lauren, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, Notre Dame business professor James O'Rourke says the state of the U.S. Postal Service is grim and that too much of it is because of politics. Why he says the agency could shut down without help within a year. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. A few weeks ago, concerned citizens across the nation began noticing U.S. Postal Service pickup boxes disappearing. Reports came out of sorting machines being removed from USPS mail centers. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy had said that the moves were part of an initiative to cut costs and make the U.S. Postal Service more efficient. But many have decried the actions as a conscious effort to slow down the mail, which could affect the delivery of mail-in ballots ahead of the general election. The Postmaster General denies this and has since agreed to postpone these changes to the service until after the election. Here to talk with us about this is James O'Rourke, Professor of Management at the University of Notre Dame's Mendoza College of Business. Professor O'Rourke, thanks for being here.
Well, you're welcome, Matt. Happy to do this.
So you said recently that unless Congress takes action, we only have maybe another year of the U.S. Postal Service as we know it. What do you mean by that?
Well, it isn't difficult to track their costs and their revenues. Those are part of public documents, part of a 10-K published annually. And the Postal Service has been experiencing diminished revenues for a number of years. Part of that is due to a decrease in first-class postage and letters being delivered. There's also a decrease in business-class marketing mail, magazines, newspapers, those sorts of things. And at the same time, their costs are increasing. So if you track those two lines out, it seems to me that they will cross sometime next summer between June and August. So I would say mid to late July, the Postal Service will be out of cash, unable to meet payroll, unable to purchase motor gas or to pay for needed supplies from vendors. My sense is that they would volunteer their time and allow people to come pick up their mail, but, you know, within 30 days, there wouldn't even be that. So if the current administration is keen to see that happen, it's easy to see how, in fact, that will come to pass. The United States of America, for the first time in 245 years, would have no post office. I said to a friend in the hallway just the other day, if that happens, we look like a third world nation. And he looked right at me and said, Jim, third world nations have really good post offices. He said they depend on those and the service is considered reliable and affordable. But this has been going on for quite some time. Do I think the administration, if given another term, would allow that to happen? That's an open question. I don't know. I know that there are just as many Democrats as Republicans that are disadvantaged by the closure of the Postal Service. But it's clear to me that what the Postmaster General said the other day in testimony to the House Administration and Oversight Committee is not completely true, that his moves are designed to make the post office more efficient. But all you have to do is look at the numbers and you can tell that removing sorting machines, picking up postal drop boxes, diminishing overtime will not close the gap. The financial gap is enormous, and that's not even going to come close. So at best, I think that looks like a cover story.
Do you see any potential benefit whatsoever, though, to these moves that we've seen so far, you know, the removing of pickup boxes, sorting machines, and the things you're talking about?
Well, in the near term, no. In the long term, you have to do controlled studies and ask where people leave mail to be picked up by the Postal Service. Do they leave it in their own post box? Do they go to the post office? Is there a mailbox at work? So I think you would have to follow the deposits in those corner boxes and track those over time, and then look at the cost and value of retaining most of those. I suspect some of them in urban areas will be quite busy. Others may be less so. But those moves are not going to, first, close the cost-revenue gap. Secondly, they're not improving service.
I mean, these actions may seem political to those who are perhaps most concerned about them, but you've looked at this for a long time. Are the problems now just an extension of the problems we've been seeing, or have politics exacerbated this?
Well, it's both. It's both. I think if you go all the way back to the last couple of decades of the last century, a movement in politics in this country, and I should tell you that I'm not a political scientist. I'm a business school professor. But a movement in this country people are familiar with called neoconservatism asked the question about whether government could be smaller and whether government could be more efficient. And I think initially they found a number of people really enthusiastic about it. Of the neoconservatives I can name, I think Grover Norquist and Dick Cheney come to mind as among the important actors. Their idea really was to reduce the size of government and, where possible, get rid of activities, organizations, or functions of the government that could be easily outsourced or sold privatized, if you will, to the private sector. These politicians were great fans of Margaret Thatcher in the UK. Mrs. Thatcher was prime minister when I was a student at Cambridge University in the United Kingdom. And the idea was put everything in private hands and the private sector will take care of this. In theory, it sounds good. It looks good on paper, but you have to see how it plays out. One of the problems with this approach is an issue of trust. You know, would I trust, for example, Comcast if the government were to sell the National Weather Service to Comcast? They own AccuWeather, and the idea is you would pay for a weather forecast. You want a forecast? Get out your Visa card. There are other agencies that are in similar positions. It wouldn't surprise me if the government tried to sell the U.S. Forest Service to a forest products management company like Georgia Pacific. I've seen proposals actually on paper circulated that would sell the National Park Service to an entertainment management firm like the Walt Disney Company. They're certainly capable of doing that, but I think most people have accustomed themselves to the idea that these are possessions of the Commonwealth, of the people of the United States, rather than businesses designed to make a profit. The real difference between the way the government operates and the way the private sector operates is that the private sector, while there are, of course, some regulatory agencies that look at safety and a variety of issues, the private sector isn't obligated to do anything in particular. And so if, you know, Comcast wants to drop service to some part of the country, they certainly can do that if they want to, particularly if it's not profitable. If you look at the package delivery services such as UPS or FedEx, they will tell you freely that they don't deliver everywhere and they only deliver at a profit. And so do a little cost comparison, take that 11 by 14 envelope with 12, 14 ounces in the envelope to the post office. They'll want $1.65, $1.80 to mail that. If you go over to FedEx, the opening bid is likely to be something around $19, depending on where it's going. Mm. The post office is obligated to take that letter you put a 49-cent stamp on down the longest dirt road to the last house in western Montana, and they do it happily. If the post office were privatized, we would be handing a required service mentioned in Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution that we've had in operation for 245 years, and we'd be handing it to the private sector. And if they want to get out of that business, they can. If they want to do it differently or charge more, they certainly can.
Well, I mean, the government steps in where markets don't work, right? I mean,
correct.
That's education. That's things like, well, I guess the Postal Service. But I mean, do you see?
Well, the fire department.
And the fire department.
You don't make a lot of money if there aren't a lot of fires. And actually, you're kind of hoping there aren't any. And so a fire department is a really good example of a cost sunk by local citizens knowing that they might not use it, but the probability of a fire is not zero.
It's really hard to imagine a sitting president and his administration allowing something like the U.S. Postal Service to dissolve or fail. Surely something will be done. I mean, it might not look the same as we've known it to be before, but I don't know, one would hope that it'll still exist in some way. Are we being too alarmist here?
No, actually, I don't think so, though I do have a couple of speculative observations. If this president is not offered a second term, I think whoever is elected, I think they would step in and encourage the Congress of the United States to do the right thing and salvage the post office. I think if the current president were offered another term, he might well step forward in April of next year and say, I have produced a solution that will save the post office and will want credit for it. The House of Representatives has done the right thing and has put forward a bill. Speaker Pelosi promoted the bill, got 100% of Democrats, and got 26 Republicans in the House. So this is a genuinely bipartisan bill. It passed handily and was walked down the hallway to the United States Senate and put on Leader McConnell's desk. And Leader McConnell said he had no intention of sending it to committee for hearings or to send it to the floor of the Senate for an up or down vote. That bill will die in his inbox. So there isn't much an ordinary citizen can do at this point. Normally, I would say write to your congressman, but the House of Representatives has done what it can. Leader McConnell can't even produce a 51-vote majority in his own caucus. That's why we don't have any new coronavirus relief. We don't have unemployment checks or relief for essential businesses because, you know, he famously said in April of this year, let him go broke, let him declare bankruptcy. He was talking about the states. And so that's a political problem I don't really have a solution for. I do have a solution for the post office. If you can command enough votes, and it doesn't require any money. The real problem the post office, in addition to decreasing revenues and increasing costs, the real problem the post office has encountered over the last 15, 14 years began in 2006 when Senator Susan Collins introduced the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act. People are in favor of accountability and enhancement, but there was more. That became law and required the post office to pay for retirement health care benefits for workers 75 years into the future. Most of those people haven't even been hired yet. No other federal agency or private corporation has been saddled with a massive pre-funding mandate of that sort. Other agencies do have to pre-fund, but nothing like this. This is about $6.5 billion a year. That mandate expired in 2017, yet the Postal Service has continued to fund at the same rate. They've been directed to do so by the Postmaster General. They've got about a $6.9 billion payment due in September. So there is a $32.5, $33 billion trust fund sitting there waiting for postal letter carriers and employees to retire. The issue is as simple as this. The United States government should allow postal workers, letter carriers, to join Medicare. I'm a retired United States Air Force officer. I spent 20 years on active duty. I'm on Medicare. The DOD sent me a letter, said, on your 65th birthday, congratulations, you're moving to Medicare. Good luck. I would say I didn't need luck. Medicare was good. It's not just good, it's brilliant. It's seamless. They're easy to deal with, and it's not free. You know, I have to pay for it. I pay for my wife's account, but it works very nicely, just as intended. I paid into that system for 50 years. I'm still paying for it, but it really does what my wife and I need it to do. That is the sort of help the postal workers need. The idea of a defined benefit pension or a defined benefit healthcare system has lived its useful lifetime. It's gone. Those days are over. Here's the real problem, though. This has come along at a point, this would have been solved if it were not politically useful to the current administration. It is politically useful for the president, I'm sorry to say, to sow doubt, mistrust, and fear over the performance of the Postal Service. When he said nobody will know where the ballots are, there'll be mass confusion, it'll be total fraud, his own Postmaster General went before the Congress of the United States and said, no, we can deliver those ballots. And I actually believe him. I've looked at the numbers. The Postal Service handled about 1.2 billion pieces of mail in November of last year, just before Christmas. In October of this year, they won't yet be at the Christmas rush. And if they have to handle an additional 15 or 18 million pieces, that's a day at the beach. Easily done, I think. I have great faith in postal workers, but I see some very troubling signs.
James O'Rourke is professor of management at the University of Notre Dame's Mendoza College of Business. Professor O'Rourke, thank you for your time and your insight.
You're most welcome, and thanks for the privilege.
Up next, an Indianapolis-based executive has written a new book about working from home. She's been looking at it and talking about it for the last decade and a half. But how does it change productivity? How do you manage it? What more should we know about it now that so many of us are going to be doing it in one form or another for the foreseeable future? That's next. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The pandemic has forced the issue of working at home, for better or for worse. Before this new normal, the debate raged over whether working from home would offer the same level of productivity as the traditional office setting. And in many ways, that debate is far from over. But we know a little more now about what it's like to work from home and whether or not we get the same amount of work done. Karen Manji is an Indianapolis-based executive with Salesforce and the author of Working from Home, Making the New Normal Work for You. Karen Manji, welcome to All In.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So how long have you been thinking about the idea of working from home before it was forced on us?
I always say I was working from home before it was cool or coerced. And I thought back to my first interview I ever did on this topic, and believe it or not, it was in 2002.
Wow.
So I would say I've been thinking about it for quite some time, just hadn't really realized how relevant those insights and those experiences would be right now.
One of the big points in this book is the idea of redefining success. What do you mean by that in the context of the pandemic and the idea of working from home?
Well, I observed that we started in this phase of adrenaline. I mean, we were all taken very by surprise mm-hmm. at how quickly we had to shift from life as we knew it to something very different. And I think in that adrenaline phase, it's whatever it takes, you know, to be healthy, keep our family safe, do what we need to do for our careers. And that quickly became the honeymoon is over because the adrenaline wears off and it's exhausting. And now we're at this place, I think, of people asking, how long is this going to last? And while no one knows the answer to that question, I think pressing pause to think about what success means to you right now is useful because it helps you put your energy where it's needed most toward that definition of success instead of trying to sustain that adrenaline-fueled state, you know, running from meeting to meeting and task to task all the time.
You've said that there's two words successful people need to jettison from their vocabulary. What are they and why?
Have you ever heard or said any of these phrases before? Like, we should be back to work by now. I should be able to work from home and do e-learning with my kids by now. The pandemic should be over by now. And what I've discovered is those two words, by now, kind of a tagline for suffering, not for success. I mean, they put you in a mindset that success should have already happened and put a lot of pressure on you to make something happen that might be well beyond your control right now.
And you write about putting work in its place. What does that mean?
Work is an invited guest, and it will only show up where you let it. And so, the challenge of what happens is, you know, we get to this scope creep place. And I think two things happen. It gets tempting to take your laptop or your work all over your house. I mean, let's be honest. We've all been the person that's done some email, lying in bed late at night, early in the morning. Then suddenly, you know, it's also happening at your dining room table and, you know, on your back porch. And suddenly, you know, work is taking over every aspect of your life. I think the other piece of it, too, is, you know, when you think about doing your best work, allocate a space to it so you are in the mindset that this is the place where you do work. I mean, replicate whatever your office scenario was before by saying, oh, I go to this place. Work happens here. When I leave, work no longer happens. I'm into my life. I'm going to transition.
So do you, I mean, can we get a little more specific? Can you give me some examples of putting work in its place, like as it might apply to somebody who is sort of having that struggle of maybe working too much or maybe not balancing work life?
Your laptop is your pantry. And what I've observed is happening is when you're at home, it's easy to take your glass and go get it some more water or make another cup of tea or coffee. And along the way, you open the pantry and you eat a few chips, right? And then maybe it's a little bit of the cookies that the kids baked last night, then the leftovers in the refrigerator are silently calling your name. And what happens is, you know, grazing all day long is not healthy as a habit. And the same thing happens with work. You know, you walk by and it gets very easy to give in to what I call just one more syndrome. So it's just one more email, just one more, you know, PowerPoint slide, just one more text. And then suddenly we find ourselves asking, you know, where did the nights and weekends go? And so what I've discovered is people need routines, rituals, and boundaries. I mean, think about it. You might not have loved your commute in the past or trying to get your kids out the door and get them to school or to daycare. What that did, though, was it said there's a certain set of activities that set me up to go do work. And on the flip side, at the end of the day, there are some catalysts, whether that's picking up the kids, coaching soccer practice, going to gym, a happy hour, that have me put work in its place and have a boundary that says, I'm leaving now. Time to change the channel, time to turn it off. And we need to be purposeful about establishing those in our at-home work environment.
What might the future look like once we get beyond the pandemic? We'll all have a pretty good idea of what working from home is like. And so I would imagine it's going to be a little bit more common. Do you foresee a future where people sort of have the choice between working from home or being in the office, not on an either or basis, but on sort of a mixed basis?
The future is flexible. And when we survey people right now and ask them questions about their preferences, you know, people indicate that most of all, what they want is choice. What you said, they want the autonomy to be able to choose when they're at their best or need to be in a physical office with colleagues and when they could be doing their job from home and be more effective or perhaps more effectively balance their lives. And I think about what happens with watching movies. I mean, people still enjoy going to a movie theater because you have that shared experience of the big laugh or the suspense or the big screen, whatever that looks like for you. But that doesn't mean you exclusively want that option. You might still like watching Netflix at home. And what you want is the choice of how you consume it for your optimal experience. And the future of work is very much like that.
The implications on the economy, as we know it, are huge when it comes to this future of working from home. I mean, I foresee a decreased relevance in commercial real estate, for instance, but I am not an expert by any means. What do we know about the consequences of this potential future?
It's sort of short term, long term when we start to think about it. Of course, in the short term, we're seeing lots of companies let go of their leases or unfortunately be in a position that they can no longer pay. And what starts to happen is, of course, that puts pressure on the entire economic system, right? Banks, restaurants that were in that area, people, you know, and businesses that served folks who were coming to those locations. And so as we rethink, you know, what could happen with space, you know, one example that comes to mind is some of the work that big retailers are doing to put their distribution centers into old shopping malls. Right? They're finding a new purpose for old space. And I think, you know, looking toward the future is how do we think in an innovative and resourceful way about how to repurpose the space that we have for new opportunities. You know, could we do more to have education take place in some of these buildings? Could we do more to, you know, attract other types of, you know, ways that people need to interact that need space, but maybe they need to be spread out? So I think it's forcing a radical rethink on space and buildings and utilization and tapping into some innovation at a much faster pace than we might have expected to see in that sector.
We're talking with Karen Manji, an Indianapolis-based executive with Salesforce and the author of the new book, Working from Home, Making the New Normal Work for You. So what I'm hearing is that we're not looking at this sort of, in some ways, I guess, almost dystopian-looking future where there's this wasteland of wasted properties. It's a repurposing. Things are changing. Things are going to change because of this and this new realization that we can do this.
Yes. And when we were talking about that releasing kind of buy now, I would offer two words that are on the opposite side, because this can feel overwhelming. You know, when you start to break down the myriad of potential implications, and I think accessing some of that beginner's mindset and digging deeper on innovation is all about asking, why not? I mean, you know, when you think about repurposing space or what can happen for communities that attract people who are remote workers into their cities, you know, explore that. Why not? I mean, at this point, there is no idea that is too outlandish, and everyone can participate in putting forward new paths forward. I mean, this is our first pandemic together as a humanity. And that means, you know, everyone's having a shared experience and can access some new ideas and solutions that might be of greater benefit.
I want to go back to something you just mentioned. Are places trying actively to attract remote workers, people who aren't tied to a physical location? So basically, you have the freedom to keep your job but live wherever you want. Places are offering incentive for that?
Cities, communities, and countries are literally offering incentives for people to relocate. And I think about, in Oklahoma, they wanted to attract a more diverse population who had jobs in different kinds of industries to the local areas, to the rural areas. And they offered a literal incentive for people to relocate, understanding that if you come there with a job and you're paying taxes there, you're helping feed a better system for education and healthcare and literally diversifying the community. So we're seeing an increasing number of cities, communities, and countries offering incentives to do just that. And we're starting to see a population exit from big metropolitan areas like a San Francisco, where someone's saying, hey, if I can't enjoy the upside benefits of this location, or work doesn't have to be a physical office I go into, do I really want to be living at this price point? So it's been a tool for diversification. We expect to see more of it. And the United Nations is really looking at this in the direction of creating more sustainable communities.
Okay, well, that leads to this. I mean, I would assume that working from home is more environmentally sustainable. Is there evidence for that?
There is evidence for that, where people are doing less commuting. I mean, for many people, if you look out in the sky wherever you live, you see people on social media reporting seeing the stars for the first time or a sky that isn't hazy. So you don't even have to be an environmental scientist to see and feel the effects of what it's like to go outside and breathe fresh air and be able to see the stars at night before you go to sleep.
Is there, though, risk to the employee? I mean, it depends on the job. It depends on the job. But a lot of jobs require that you come into the office at least occasionally. Is there risk to an employee who has a job like that, where you're kind of expected to be there occasionally, and you decide you want to move away, and are you going to have to buy a plane ticket ever so often?
Well, there was a fantastic survey. It was called Leading the Leaders. It was a survey of almost 2,000 people managers. And I think it's particularly relevant because that, especially middle layer of management, I think, is the perimeter of success or failure in work from home. I mean, these are the people interfacing with employees to understand how they're feeling. And they're also the part of any company or organization that executives are counting on to deliver results. And in the survey, what was interesting is they studied 434 attributes of what do employees most want and value from their employers. And the biggest things were relationships. You know, can I show up as myself? And also ownership. Like, am I clear about what I own and do I have the autonomy to go do it? So what we see people needing to solve for more than anything is those feelings of being isolated and invisible. Because, you know, the two questions I think that are at the forefront of the conversation right now are, most people could physically turn out work from just about any location. The thing that's on people's minds, if you're a manager, it's how do I know my employees are working? And for its employees, it's how does my boss know how hard I'm working? Right. So I think it's more about solving for that sense of community and those relationships and that visibility, as opposed to really getting prescriptive about where work has to happen.
There are a few companies that are known for their sort of unique and innovative work environments that are sort of designed to increase productivity, including the company you work for, Salesforce. They're kind of known for that as well. Have those companies, or has your company, adapted that to working from home?
We've done a couple of things to think about making the future of work flexible. So we've, you know, announced publicly that we're making work from home an option at this point through the end of July 2021.
Wow. Okay.
And many other companies have done the same. In addition to that, we have a new product that's called work.com. And the idea of work.com is to help as people are returning to offices to do so safely. So it gathers some data, you know, it checks on your social distancing, and then also the product Salesforce Anywhere to help you access, right, the information and tools you need regardless of where you're working. So we kind of think about it on both sides of the equation, which is while people are at home full time, which is still the majority of our employee base, you know, how do we make sure they're healthy and well? As we start to have people go back to the office when that's possible, how do we offer flexibility and choice? And then how do we use our own technology as a way to keep people safe?
What have other companies needed a little help with when it comes to working from home? Has anyone come asking for advice?
What people ask most frequently is how to not be working all the time, how to really put some fun back into the environment, and then really looking in the direction of culture. You know, I've talked to so many executives, CEOs especially, who said, well, before this, I never believed in remote work. I didn't think people would be working, and I have been proven wrong. And now that I've been proven wrong and, you know, the company is doing great or people are still producing results, I need to rethink the culture so that work from home doesn't just become something that's allowed. It becomes something that's accepted. You know, how do we build this into the culture? And as a leader, what do I need to do differently? How do we need to communicate differently? You know, what other benefits might we need to put in place? How could this really look? So it's forcing a cultural inflection point. And a lot of senior executives talk to me in back rooms and say, listen, I was totally wrong. I take it back. But help me with the path forward.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but are you at home right now?
I am at home right now. Wouldn't it be awkward if I were talking to you from like Hawaii or something?
Karen Manji is VP of Customer and Market Insights at Salesforce, and she's based out of Indianapolis. She's also the author of the new book, Working from Home, Making the New Normal Work for You. Karen Manji, thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me, and I wish everyone great success and progress on this new playbook.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Monday, we'll continue our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards when we take a look at the children's book category. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana for discussion and topic alerts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is All In.